from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, we begin with a story that has lost history, DNA science, royalty, celebrity, and Shakespeare all involved in it, the discovery of the skeleton of Richard III, who remains in large part, due to Shakespeare's portrayal of him as a villain, one of those historic figures that continue to be passionately argued about. What will the discovery of his remains tell us about him, and how were scientists able to authenticate a royal body some 500 years old? Then we'll discuss a local ordinance that is being proposed in San Francisco that would require seismic retrofitting in so-called soft-story buildings. Should owners of buildings throughout the earthquake-vulnerable Bay Area be required to pay for seismic safety? Join us for Forum straight ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. 500 years after he died in battle, scientists have discovered the skeleton of King Richard III under a British parking lot. The short-reigned monarch is known as a Machiavellian hunchback who purportedly committed atrocious murders on his journey to the throne. But the king has modern-day supporters who say he was unfairly maligned, both by the Tudor monarchs who succeeded him and in William Shakespeare's portrayal of him. We want to discuss the finding and the legacy of King Richard III. And as I said, this has a little bit of many things that you can't even put your hands on. Lost history, DNA science, royalty, celebrity, not to mention, well, Elizabethan world of the Tudors and Shakespeare. And we thought we'd check in first with Henry Chu, who is London bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times and who has been covering the story, which, by the way, made page 2 on today's San Francisco Chronicle. Henry Chu, welcome to Forum.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin by talking about this discovery. I mean, it's major news in the UK, found under a parking lot in the ruins of an old church, but the DNA has been confirmed. It's incontrovertible.
It has indeed. That was kind of the clincher for the expert team that was working on the excavation and then the identification of the remains. But not just the DNA. They had other testing, for example, radiocarbon dating to find out from which century this skeleton dated to. And they discovered that that, too, was a match and that this person, this adult male who died around the end of the 15th century, which is exactly when Richard III died at the Battle of Bosworth Field. And so with pieces of the puzzle coming together, they came to the conclusion that this is pretty definitively the skeleton of this lost king that had pretty much lain in the ground there for over 500 years, much of it just completely in secret with nobody knowing that it was there.
Well, they got to it because archaeologists work from old maps, right?
That's right. It was a pretty amazing story from an archaeology point of view because you were talking about an excavation that was hampered by both limited time and limited space. They were only given about 3.5 weeks to work in this parking lot. And the parking lot itself, which I've been to, is fairly small. You could pace it off on either side within a few seconds. And this is we're talking about the city center of a major urban area in Britain, and this is one of the very, very few unbuilt-up spots within this downtown. And so the fact that that was actually even available for them to dig is another sort of miraculous part of the story. But they did start digging at the very end of August last year, and within a few days, they struck pay dirt, found some of the ruins of the old friary from the medieval era that was located beneath the topsoil there, and then they found the skeleton actually fairly quickly, although they didn't announce it right away, and were completely blown away by the fact that there was this intact skeleton lying there just a few feet beneath the surface.
An intact skeleton, we should mention, also with, from what they've been able to determine, scoliosis, which may have indeed been what accounted for his spine curvature, what was called a hunchback and all that, but also head trauma and hands crossed at the wrists, meaning they'd been tied. I mean, it's pretty clear that the way he was killed, I mean, and we're talking about a corpse that's 500 years old.
Yeah, that's pretty much a testament to modern science in many ways. And they had an osteologist, a bone expert, looking at it who was able to determine that there were 10 different wounds on the body, on the skeleton. 8 of them were located on the head alone. So on parts around the skull. Two of them were fatal in and of themselves. They were from heavy-bladed instruments and weapons that had struck this this individual. And then they also discovered wounds that were probably inflicted after death, which, what they called humiliation injuries, because here was the opposing forces of the future Henry VII parading the naked, bound body of Richard III. They had indeed conquered the sitting king, and perhaps there were those who wanted to add insult to injury and inflicted more wounds on the body as it was taken throughout the city.
And then the Tudors got to tell their story, and Shakespeare, that's under right. Queen Elizabeth, got to tell the story. I mean, to the victors go, well, whatever history may be or turns out to be. Henry Chu, again, with us from London. He is London Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, been covering this story. Big story in England, to say the least.
Absolutely. He was the only monarch left who did not have either an official tomb or identified remains to his name. So the fact that they were actually able to find the skeleton, and now they're planning a burial for him in the nearby cathedral.
Not in Westminster Abbey, though.
No, there were some who demanded that and said that he was due full royal honors and should be buried alongside other kings and queens in Westminster Abbey, but no, that's not going to happen.
Well, Henry Chu, I thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time with us. Henry Chu, again, London Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, and continues to be very passionate feelings about Richard III. Was he a villain? Was he maligned? There are ways of reckoning with this, perhaps. I don't know if the skeleton is going to give us some better insight, but we thought we'd talk with a couple of experts. Roland Green is here in studio with us. He's Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Stanford, and Mark Pigott, OBE Professor in the School of Humanities and Sciences. We welcome you. Good morning. Also say good morning to Rosemary Joyce, who is Professor of Anthropology, University of California in Berkeley, and she joins us this morning from Panola in the East Bay. Welcome, Rosemary Joyce.
Thank you.
Glad to have you both here with us. And Professor Green, let me begin with you. I mean, there's still a lot of facts that we don't know about Richard III. We don't know about those two nephews of his who were shut up in the Tower mm-hmm. of London, even. But he may be a really complex character because there were a lot of things that he did. Innocent until proven guilty. Bail, as we know it today, helping the poor, easing it for book publishing. I mean, he made some real contributions.
No, he was a very complex figure for that time. And it's the difficulty of sorting out his historical veracity from the legend is that it's clouded by Thomas More and Shakespeare, who wrote very powerful propaganda that gets between us and the historical reality. He only reigned for a couple of years, so it was quite a tumultuous time.
There is, it continues to be, and has been for many years, a Richard III Society, which tries to take the villain and evil luster away from him.
So I'm told.
They were involved in this dig, in fact.
Apparently they were. Well, you know, monarchs from the distant past have their advocates in the present day, whether it's through actual family relations or some kind of long-distance historical identification. But I think they were very important in this process.
Well, Shakespeare was pleasing Queen Elizabeth also. I mean, the Tudors were, as we've said, very much in favor of Richard III being maligned and being made into an evil character. What can we really learn, though, from now that we've got his skeleton intact?
I think it's it is a commemorative and an affective event more than really a historical event, in the sense that commemorative because it takes us back to that moment in 1485 that's really the end of the Middle Ages in England and the beginning of the Renaissance, and affective because people feel for that mortal body that's under a parking lot.
Mortal but regal, too. I mean, there's a difference between those two bodies, isn't there?
Well, as you know, Michael, in the later Middle Ages and the Renaissance, there was a doctrine of the king's two bodies, which conceptualized the difference between the physical body that gets sick and gets old and the regal body, the body politic, that is the body in which the kingship resides. And anytime you see the mortal body of a king, whether dead or alive, you could say the same thing about the present-day Queen of England, one is always struck by the mortal aspect and the frailty of a physical body. And at the same time, people always want to look for the lineaments of kingship in such a body.
And Roland Green here in studio, Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Stanford, and Rosemary Joyce is Professor of Anthropology at UC Berkeley. Professor Joyce, this is really quite a scientific story in many ways, detective story, yeah?
It's actually a great example of modern archaeology, including the way that a team of interdisciplinary experts collaborated once the remains were found. But even beginning before that, the location of that tiny strip of unworked through land from historic maps, the probability that it was the Grey Friars Priory, and the team from the University of Leicester sort of laid out a set of goals, and the least likely goal they felt was being able to recover and identify the remains of Richard III. But even had they not done that, they would have been giving us back this historical location that was destroyed during the reign of Henry VIII. Once they actually found a skeleton that had a position in the church near the altar, so a position of respect, that had that twisted spine from scoliosis, and that had the evidence of having been basically died from really violent trauma to the head, they could go forward and try to identify whether this could be Richard III, and that is actually a multiple step process itself that brought in all sorts of contemporary science.
Well, there's carbon dating, there's isotope analysis, there's all of that and more, and mitochondrial DNA particularly, which frankly isn't always a perfect match. Two people could have the same type, in fact,
yes.
By chance. But
there
here,
was some, yeah,
we
there
was, I mean, it was nailed down here because I'm just going to get this on the record. They were able to go to a descendant of Anne, his sister. Who was a cabinet maker named Ibsen, interestingly enough, if you know the Norwegian playwright, Michael Ibsen. And through that, as I said, it's incontrovertible. It is Richard III.
Well, and it's more than just being able to trace that line of women over 17 generations from mother to daughter to arrive at this cabinet maker's mother, actually, who passed on the same mitochondrial DNA to her son. So that it starts with being able to trace that line of descent from Richard's mother and sister. But the mitochondrial DNA type that they happen to share is itself quite rare in Britain. It's only 1 to 2% of the population shares it. So they could have been unlucky and found that this was a much more widespread mitochondrial DNA profile, but they had good luck in that sense in that this was a rare type. And then they had a second descendant through the maternal line that was found, who's remained anonymous. And that really helps because now you have two descendants, both with this same rare profile, and the remains have the same rare profile. And that gives us as close as we ever get in archaeology to certainty.
Well, this is a half-hour segment, so if you have something to say about this, some response to it, or if you have questions, the time to join us would be now, and we invite you to do that, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. 500 years after he died in battle, scientists have discovered the skeleton of Richard III, known as a Machiavellian hunchback, largely because of the portrayal by William Shakespeare, and known as a villain and an evil character, nevertheless has had modern-day supporters who say he was unfairly maligned, both by the Tudor monarchs who succeeded him and in Shakespeare's portrayal. Feel free to join us, and you can do that right now by calling us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. And as I said earlier, this is a story that has a little bit of something for everyone. We welcome your involvement and contribution to the conversation. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. Join us now, or you can join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or posting your responses and questions and comments on our website, which is at kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is at @kqedforum. And Rosemary Joyce, we going to learn anything from these bones that we didn't know before? I mean, in terms of settling once and for all some of the controversies that have raged about Richard III?
Well, what the bones can tell us is about the actual life that he lived, not about his policies or his character, but they've already begun telling us things that perhaps we didn't already know. In doing the radiocarbon analysis, one of the things the scientists had to do was correct it because he ate so much marine fish in his diet that his radiocarbon was affected by a difference between marine animals and terrestrial animals. So that tells us that, as we might have suspected for somebody in the wealthy class, that he was eating a diet high in meat and in fish. We also, from the diagnosis of the kind of scoliosis he suffered from, we know that it was something that started when he would have been about 10 and probably was progressive. so we can start seeing this person as a young boy who, when he reached about the age 10, began to suffer from this disease and how that might have affected him in life. And once they actually continue with the analysis of other isotopes, other chemistry in the bone, we might learn more about his movements in youth, because there's a record of what you ate, where you lived, and what experiences you had. We might even be able to tell what kind of athletic abilities he did repeatedly, because you get something like tennis elbow in the modern U.S. It leaves muscles that are used repeatedly leave marks on the bones, which we can actually see.
Well, in Rolling Green, we learned certainly that he did diet the Battle of Bosworth Field. In fact, I guess it was Henry VII who killed him, and that ended the War of the Roses. And we know now again that how he was killed and the ways in which he was killed.
And there's something very prosaic about realizing that the legend of the hunchback with the withered arm, it really amounts to scoliosis in real life and these kind of physical, incontrovertible physical conditions that one can see in the body. It reminds you of the imaginative distance between the prosaic physical reality and the legend spun by Moore and Shakespeare.
Well, also, when someone had something like scoliosis, it was God's will, and they were associated with
Absolutely.
Evil, and they were cursed, and so there was all of that as
Absolutely.
Well. By the way, we got a tweet here from Matt who says, waiting for Richard III, the movie Quentin Tarantino directs, and some of you may have seen Kevin Spacey playing Richard III when he was here in San Francisco. Let's go to your calls, and we begin, Andrew, with you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Just wanted to say I'm a cartographer and a geographic analyst, so I want to give a shout-out to the cartographic elements of how the archaeologists worked with this. And when I was working with the National Park Service here in San Francisco, we took old insurance maps, and I was able to overlay them and stretch them and rubber sheet them is the word, over the Sutro Baths area to see that they used to sell beer and oyster chowder in a certain area. So I overlaid it over the aerial photos, went up with the archaeologists, and after just a few minutes of shallow digging, sure enough, we turned up oyster shells and beer bottles.
Well, we'll give that shout-out to the cartographers. And, Andrew, thank you. Also, there was a whole team here, Rosemary Joyce, University of Leicester, yeah?
Yes, there was. But your caller's absolutely right. The Roberts map, as it's called, from 1741, was the first concrete piece of evidence that indicated where that priory had been before it was destroyed in 1558. So old maps were really important, and they were important because they showed over time, from that 1741 to the present, that this little piece of land had not been built up, even though, as your first correspondent said, this is a big city, and you would expect large pieces of territory like this to have been built over. So it starts with our cartographer, and then it goes on with ground-penetrating radar, which is one of our new tools in our arsenal, where you can actually take an instrument over the surface before you ever excavate and find images that suggest where walls were. And that made it possible for them. They actually hit the remains of Richard III on the first day.
Let me bring
in
another another caller in, and that's Mari. Good morning.
Good morning. Fascinating topic. I just wanted to make a comment and then ask a question as well. Yesterday when I was reading this story, I was fascinated by the fact that he was found buried with no coffin and not even a shroud. And the question that I wanted to ask was, were other cadavers found, were other skeletons found buried in the same area, or do they think that he was the only body that was buried there?
Rosemary Joyce, I think he was the only body they found.
No,
there,
he wasn't the only body
no?
there.
No.
This was the inside of a church, and there were other burials, but they were formal. They had burial markings, and so the contrast is really quite stark. This was somebody hastily buried in a place that was sometimes used for burial and closest to the altar of all the burials they found.
You want to add something here, Roland Green?
Only that... the appearances of his burial that I read about were that it was he was basically thrown into a spot that was away from where the other bodies were.
That's why I was thinking about it as being isolated somehow, but there were other bodies there clearly. And we're going to go to more calls here. And Marty is next. Marty, join us on Forum. Welcome.
Good morning. He did more than die. Didn't Richard III lead the last crusade to the Promised Land and slaughter the Akko? I'd love to hear some of the highlights of his historical timeline.
Do we know about Richard III in terms of the Crusades, Rosemary Joyce?
I'd have to ask a historian.
Roland, you're not clear on that either.
He was not a crusader, no.
He was not a crusader. No, okay. No. Let me thank the caller and go to more of your calls, and we go to Max next. Max, join us.
Thank you for taking my call. Fascinating. I have a question about facial reconstruction. Closer to us, they went through that in Venezuela. They reconstructed the face of Bolivar. And there was an uproar following that because Bolivar came out as a pure product of the Caribbean, a mulatto. And the historians in Venezuela, some of them were in an uproar about that because the people, the contemporaries of Bolivar who painted him, always presented him as a European, a man of European descent, pure European descent. I'd like to have your feedback on that. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Can we go to you on that, Professor Joyce?
Yeah. Facial reconstruction, which is a very specialized kind of technique, has not been done on the skeleton of Richard III yet. It might well be. And as your caller says, sometimes the results are surprising. In the case of Simon Bolivar, the facial reconstruction doesn't match the historical portraiture. And this is a neat illustration of the fact that archaeology and art history and documentary history are complementary, and sometimes we have contradictions, and those become historically interesting.
Well, I'm also thinking of another historically interesting, antecedent to what was discovered in England, and that's Tsar Nicholas II and the whole family, who were pretty much murdered by the Bolsheviks, probably, but there was all that talk about Anastasia for so long, and we were able to discover quite a bit a number of years ago about the Romanov children. And what actually happened to them. Looking at some emails here, here's Bill who says, I heard on the news this morning that the city of York is claiming Richard III's skeleton since he spent a large portion of his life there and was crowned there. Lester's saying, no way, is the University of Leicester. Douglas says, I believe Richard III was my 24th great-granduncle. While I do not challenge the many evil deeds he is accused of doing, people should be thankful for presumption of innocence and bail, both of which he is credited with introducing. And another listener says, I thought the mystery writer Josephine Tay had taken care of this unfair maligning of Richard III definitively in her 1951 book, The Daughter of Time. Do either of our resident academics here know that book? Or?
It's a famous book of historical revisionism. Yeah, it is. I have to confess I've never read it. But.
Well, do you know it, Rosemary Joyce?
Yes, actually. It's, you know, again, at the top of the program, you mentioned that there are people who have been engaged for a long time in trying to rehabilitate Richard III's mm-hmm. reputation. And what Josephine Tay basically did, and she's mainly a novelist, a fictional writer, was to try to give a portrait that would be more sympathetic of the man in his times and the pressures that he would have been under, that then, as you've said, the Tudors, who were the other side, gave us winner's history, which had to make him a negative figure. And in that negative portrayal, it's important to underline that his physical suffering from scoliosis may well have made him someone who was looked at askance even during his lifetime.
Well, he's always seen as this homicidal tyrant who killed his two young nephews to gain the throne by many, but there are those who continue to argue just the opposite. Richard III reigned from 1483 to 1485. Quite a story, discovery of an intact skeleton, and we're learning more all the time. I want to thank Henry Chu, London Bureau Chief with the LA Times. Thanks to you, Roland Green, Professor at Stanford of English and Comparative Literature. And thanks to you, Rosemary Joyce.
Thank you.
Professor of Anthropology, UC Berkeley. When we come back, we'll shift gears. We're going to talk about seismic retrofitting in California, northern, that is. I'm Michael Krasny.